It's Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from radio's golden age. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Livonier. True history coming up in this hour. Later on, the story of the telegraph on the cavalcade of America. But right now, a dedication on radio's Death Valley Days, heard on October 28, 1937, marking the opening of the Mount Whitney to Death Valley Highway.
Morning bugle call of the covered wagon trains fades away among the echoes. Another of the old ranger's true stories of Death Valley days is brought to you by the Pacific Coast Borax Company. And now, old ranger, are you all set for tonight's program?
Yes, Dresser. Everything is ready, so go right ahead with the introduction.
Friends, our Death Valley Days program tonight is something entirely different. We're going to present a preview of the 3-day ceremonies which will take place this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to celebrate the opening of the new Mount Whitney Death Valley Highway, a highway that will link the highest and the lowest points of the United States. We hope that many people listening in tonight will be able to attend this unusual celebration, but since there are thousands of people who will not be able to be present, the Old Ranger has prepared this special program. All set, Old Ranger, the show is yours.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to our radio preview of the Mount Whitney Death Valley Highway dedication program. The eyes of all California are turned toward this, its newest and most dramatic highway. The most unusual highway in all the world. Furnace Creek Inn is going to open several days ahead of time to accommodate the crowds of visitors who want to be present at the climax of the ceremonies in Death Valley. This new highway, as Dresser just told you, will connect the highest and the lowest points in the United States, Mount Whitney and Death Valley. Oddly enough, they're not so very far apart, less than 100 miles as the crow flies, and both in the same county, but separated by mountain ranges and a waste of desert. From a certain point in the Funeral Mountains, you can look up and look down and see them both. The snow-capped summit of Mount Whitney, 14,496 feet above the sea, and the floor of Death Valley, 279 feet below sea level. Daddy's view, they call it, a vision of heaven and hell. Now, with the completion of this new highway, the two will be brought together. Mountain and desert will be united. To symbolize this union, the waters of one will be carried to the waters of the other and there mingle. It's the dramatic journey and wedding of the waters that we now present to you. Near the summit of Mount Whitney lies Tula Inyo, the highest lake in America. 12,865 feet above the sea. Up to 75 years ago, no white man had ever feasted his eyes upon its loveliness. But the red man knew it long before. It belonged to him, this lake in the clouds. And so it is fitting that an Indian should be chosen as the one to dip the water from Tula Inyo next Friday afternoon and start it on its journey to Death Valley. And it's fitting, too, that an Indian should describe this part of the ceremony to you. My friends, let me present Lone Bear.
The sun has passed over the crest of the Sierras and begun its descent to the Pacific. On the western slopes of Mount Whitney, the snows sparkle whitely. But to the east already lie purple shadows as an Indian steps forth from the pines that rim Tula Inyo and approaches its shores. He is a runner. In his hand he carries a gourd. He stoops down, dips the gourd into the lake, and brings it up full of crystal cold water, the highest water in America. He straightens up again, stands for a moment, then turns and disappears down the trail through the pines. The waters of Mount Whitney have started on their journey to Death Valley. The Indian runner descends swiftly, 11,000 feet, now only 10,000. The trail dips and turns, the pines grow more gigantic, more luxuriant. The evening winds make music through them, like the music of an organ. 9,000 feet. The trail enters a gorge between towering granite cliffs. There is the sound of a rushing mountain stream. It grows louder. The falls are near. Whitney Falls. Below the falls, a little lake. Beyond the lake, a clearing, a campground. Whitney Portal and the highway.
Where the highway joins the trail, a white man waits to take the gourd from the hand of the runner, a Pony Express rider.
Whoa, steady there. Be on our way in a minute, kid. Ah, here comes the engine runner now. Welcome, friend.
My brother.
You bring the gourd?
It is here.
Good.
The waters of Tulaenu have traveled to the end of the Indian trail. The red man's part is done. That white man carry from here.
The Pony Express rider takes the gourd from the Indian. He tucks it safely away in one of his saddlebags. In the other bag goes mail bearing a special cancellation and cachet and dedication stamp showing an old offshoot. In one bow, a view of Mount Whitney, in the other, a view of Death Valley. Saddlebags are closed, the rider mounts, turns his pony's head eastward, and they're off!
Get up, kid! Get up there!
Down the mountain they race toward the little town of Lone Pine, 13 miles away. 13 miles of magnificent highway. A triumph of modern road engineering. It was built by the CCC boys, and they've come up from their camp down the canyon and are gathered at the side of the road to watch the Pony Express rider go by, galloping down the grades and around the curves that were built by their hands. Here they are. In the old Pony Express days, they had no highway to travel on, no roads to speak of. In many places, not even a trail to follow. Yet they never faltered, never failed. Day and night, winter and summer, through driving rains, under blistering suns, over rivers and mountains and desert sands they rode. A gallant band, the Pony Express. We salute them. The steep slope of Mount Whitney is now behind us. On and down the Pony Express rider goes. Lone Pine is now in sight, nestled at the foot of the mountain. Ordinarily a quiet little village, but on next Friday it will be filled to overflowing. A brass band will be playing, and all eyes will be turned toward the west, where the new highway sweeps down from Mount Whitney.
Listen! The pony!
Here comes the pony!
Right up the band!
Friday night at Lone Pine. And about the only thing in the town that will rest, too. On Saturday, the gourd of water will continue on its way to Death Valley. An old prairie schooner drawn by yoke oxen will carry it from Lone Pine on the next stage of its journey. I'm going to ask Lois Austin to take up the description here. All right, Lois.
It's a thrilling sight, this great old covered wagon and its picturesque ox teams lumbering slowly out of Lone Pine eastward. The driver dressed in blue jeans and wide-brimmed hat. And beside him, a woman in sunbonnet and calico. Some of those early day covered wagons crossed the very country that this wagon will travel over Saturday. Then it was a trackless waste. Today, every mile of the way is safe and easy. All honor to the 49ers who blaze the trails of the West for others to follow.
With my banjo on my knee. Oh, Susanna, oh, don't you cry for me. I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee. Oh, Susanna, oh, don't you cry for me. I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee.
Once they reached California, the pioneers abandoned their covered wagons and turned to pack animals to take them on their search for gold to the mother lode country in the desert. And so the gourd of water, traveling from Mount Whitney to Death Valley, is handed from the covered wagon to a prospector.
Oh, there. You got the canteen for me?
It don't happen to be a canteen. It's a gourd. Here you are.
Thanks.
You take good care of it now.
You're telling a desert rat to take good care of water?
It ain't to drink, remember?
I know. It's to be poured into the pool at the bottom of Death Valley. First time I'll bet that anybody ever throwed out good water in Death Valley on purpose.
Here's a pack of letters for you to take along with it.
Oh, I'm to be a postman too, huh? All right, let's have them.
The stagecoach will pick them up from you further along the road.
Nice, Harry.
Well, so long.
So long. Get up, Tom. So long, Gary.
There they go, the prospector and his burros, carrying the gourd of water on the next stage of its journey to Death Valley. The burrow man, symbol of a vanishing race. A race of unsung heroes who did their part to make this country of ours richer in actual wealth by hundreds of millions, whose patient footsteps led the way to hidden treasure in a wilderness that others had not dared to penetrate. The trails he used to tramp have become highways. Where once he pitched his lonely camp, towns have sprung up. The men who prospect the desert today no longer travel as he did on the hurricane deck of a jackass. They ride in automobiles, mail order prospectors, he calls them. He laughs. There's a tinge of sadness in his voice. He knows, the burrow man does, his day is over. His breed is dying out. Few that remain, and to the thousands that have passed on, our gratitude. Continues east. A few miles further on, a stagecoach waits, drawn up alongside the road. Professor, how about you taking over the next part of the story?
All right, old ranger. It's a real old-fashioned stagecoach, quote. Yes, and I'll bet it's seen plenty of travel in the state. Been held up and tipped over and had runaways and all the other adventures that stagecoaches used to have. The driver looks as if he might be the real thing, too. There's even an old Wells Fargo Express box on top, iron bound and padlocked, and the shotgun messenger riding alongside. He's not guarding bullion this trip, though, just the gourd of water from Mount Whitney and the sack of letters that have accumulated along the route. The stage draws up and transfers the gourd to a 20-mule team. That isn't a dramatic spectacle. 20 matched black mules stretched out along the highway, drawing two of the original wagons that used to haul borax out of Death Valley. The largest wagons ever built. Wheels 7 feet high, wider like freight cars. And trailing behind them, one of the tanks that held the precious supply of water for the long journey across the Mojave Desert. It's amazing, old ranger, that these old wagons should still be in working condition after so many years.
What about the driver?
Oh, don't tell me that he's...
Yes, sir. He's an original 20-mule teamster. 75 years old his last birthday, but still able to climb aboard one of the old wagons and handle the jerk line of the longest team in the world, Frank Tilton. Frank's made plenty of trips in and out of Death Valley before, but none like this. How about it, Frank?
Well, roads are quite better, but the mules, I can't see no difference from them.
They're not the original team, then, whose picture we see on the borax packages today.
Gosh, no. This team was assembled just for this special occasion. Well, I've got to be getting on. Get up there. Get up.
Settle forward into their coffins. The long chain stretches taut. As the great wagons move slowly toward Death Valley, we salute them. The men who brought the world one of the greatest treasures of the desert with the 20-mule team. 8 miles from the town of Keeler, the highway intersects an old narrow-gauge branch of the Southern Pacific Railway. Here, a special train is waiting. It was when the railroad came to the desert that the 20-mule team retired. The iron horse took over his work. So it's particularly fitting that the engineer of this train today should take the gourd of water from the hand of the 20-mule teamster and carry it on the next stage of its journey to Death Valley. There'll be a crowd in Keeler waiting to welcome the train at the end of its run, probably the biggest crowd this little place has ever known. With their brass band all lined up and ready, and here she comes. Remain at Keeler Saturday night while everybody in the town celebrates. Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, the water of Tulaino will continue on its journey, this time by automobile. Swiftly it will be carried from Keeler southeast past Owens Lake through the old mining camp of Darwin and on to the point where the actual dedication of the new highway is to take place. A brief religious ceremony occurs first. Governor Frank F. Merriam of California now steps forward to dedicate the highway.
My friends, we are gathered here this morning to dedicate...
It's a mighty impressive sight, this crowd gathered out in the heart of the desert. I recognize a number of well-known people. Air Senator William G. McAdoo is standing with a group of government officials. The state, the county, and the National Park Service are all represented. I see Colonel White, superintendent of Death Valley National Monument. And Ray Goodwin and others of their staff. Yes, there's a crowd of CC boys present, too. Father Crowley is there, that remarkable priest whose parish includes the whole of Inyo County, 10,000 square miles, the largest parish in the United States. And as for desert rats, there are swarms of them. Grizzled old fellows with faded eyes and gnarled hands and faces like parchment, dressed in flannel shirts, nondescript hats, and hobnailed boots. This is a day they never thought they'd live to see. The day when
the last barrier between mountains and desert has been removed. The top and the bottom of the United States are joined together. My friends, we dedicate the Mount Whitney Death Valley Highway.
The governor steps back. The whole crowd moves back a bit. The last barricade across the highway is broken, and the new highway is officially open. And I'm going to let Lois Austin describe this part of the ceremony for you.
A young girl has stepped forward and is walking along the road toward the place where the barricade has just been broken. She is a descendant of some of California's earliest pioneers, the famous Donner Party. From the other direction, a young man has appeared. He's walking toward the girl. He, too, is a descendant of California pioneers. His grandfather was one of the famous Manly Party. The Donner Party. The Manly Party. The mountains took their toll of the one, the desert of the other. Today, those same mountains, that same desert, have been made safe for travel. The old dangers, the old barriers have been removed. The descendants of those gallant pioneers now meet and join hands.
The cavalcade proceeds over the new highway eastward to Panamint Valley, the gourd of water in the automobile that leads the procession. In Panamint Valley, a plane is waiting to receive it and carry it on the last stage of its journey.
Automobile procession continues on the highway to Death Valley to witness the final ceremony at Badwater. It passes the spot where the 49ers abandoned their wagons and burned them, where they carved their names on a rock that is still to be seen. The procession enters Death Valley, turns south past the old Harmony Borax Works, past Furnace Creek Ranch, and begins. Down, down, till they reach the lowest point in the valley. Lowest point in the United States, Badwater, 279 feet below the level of the sea. As they approach the spot, there's the hum of an airplane to the west.
Over Telescope Peak in the Panamint appears the plane, bringing the water from Mount Whitney. It crosses the Panamint, the afternoon sun shining on its wing. It descends lower, lower. It's heading for Badwater. It's almost there. In just another second, it will reach the spot. Now! As it flies over, the gourd is dropped. Its journey is ended. The highest and the lowest waters in America are wetted. Mount Whitney and Death Valley are linked henceforth forever.
radio preview of the Mount Whitney Death Valley Highway dedication. Presented for your entertainment by the Pacific Coast Borax Company, producers of that famous family of products, 20 Mule Team Borax, 20 Mule Team Borax Soap Chips, and Boraxa. If you're planning to see this new highway this weekend or later in the season, be sure to include a visit to Death Valley in your trip. For Death Valley is the ideal winter vacation land. Here the days are filled with warm sunshine, the nights cool and bracing, and what night. A sky full of silver stars, so large and bright that you can almost touch them. A giant desert moon that lights up the entire valley. Night or day, you can swim in the beautiful outdoor swimming pool at Furnace Creek Inn. You can play tennis on fast, roomy courts, or golf on the nine-hole course over 2,800 yards long. Imagine playing golf in a desert, below sea level, on all grass, greens, and fairways. You can visit the famous mining towns the old ranger has told you about, travel over the historic trails of the 49th, or see the many strange and picturesque spots that have made Death Valley one of Uncle Sam's most interesting national monuments. You will enjoy a winter vacation in Death Valley.
Death Valley Days on Tuned to Yesterday from October 28, 1937. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now the Cavalcade of America opens up its 14th season on air, where about 8 million people were tuned in on NBC on a Monday night at 8 o'clock to hear the story of a telegraph called Wire to the West. This first heard on August 30, 1949.
Cavalcade of America. The DuPont Company, maker of better things for better living through chemistry, presents Raymond Massey in Wire to the West on Cavalcade of America. And here is Raymond Massey.
Good evening. Tonight, the DuPont Company brings Cavalcade of America back for its 15th year on the air. I've been here many times before in many roles. And on this opening night, I'm here in a new character, Hiram Sibley, a man whose work has touched the lives of every man and woman in America. And here's the story.
It's Washington, D.C., back in the middle of the last century. Mr. Hiram Sibley of Rochester, New York, enters a sleepy little telegraph office.
Anyone here? Hello? Hello?
Come in. I hear you. I ain't deep. I heard you the first time.
I want to send this telegram to Rochester.
Oh, Rochester. Got it writ out?
Of course.
Rochester's pretty expensive. You'd save yourself a lot of money if you send it to New York. Even Boston would be cheaper.
Will you please send this to Rochester?
All right, if you like. I was just advising you. Let's see now. October 4, 1849. Mrs. Elizabeth Sibley. Your wife?
Yeah, but why?
Just curious. Mrs. Elizabeth Sibley, business successfully concluded. Leave Washington today. Arrive home Tuesday. Kiss the children. Love, Hiram. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Kissing the children's going to cost you extra. Fees are $1.75 for 10 words, 25 cents a word thereafter. Still want to kiss them?
Of course.
That'll be $2.50.
There you are. When will it arrive?
Now, sir, that is a mighty good question. A mighty fine one. When will it arrive? Well, now, let's see if we can figure that out. From Washington here to New York, well, that'll be quick. That's our own line. So, let's say it'll get to New York about, 8 tonight. That means it'll start upstate New York tomorrow morning.
Why not tonight?
Oh, 'tain't our line from New York to Albany. No, no, that's another line. That means it has to be took over to the other company by messenger. and messengers, they quit at 7. Starts upstate tomorrow morning, gets to Albany, then switch to another line. Maybe it'll be on its way to Buffalo by evening.
But why Buffalo? I want this sent to Rochester.
Yes, but we just been informed that we ain't on talking terms with the company that's got a line into Rochester. We send to Buffalo. And there, it'd probably be put in the mail. The stagecoach takes a day from Buffalo to Rochester. Oh, better say 2.
Well,
I'd say it's got a pretty fair chance of arriving in Rochester early Wednesday morning.
But I'll be there myself on Tuesday.
Yeah, so you will. Well, wouldn't that be nice? Your wife won't have to bother going down to the telegraph office to get the message. You can pick it up yourself.
One 100 years ago, the infant telegraph industry teetered on the brink of chaos. Over 50 different lines, large and small, were operating along the eastern seaboard of the country, a few even reaching timidly westward towards the Mississippi. But it was progress without pattern. Messages more often than not failed to get through. Rates were raised and lowered without reason, without warning. And that was a bare 100 years ago.
I tell you, Hiram, it's a tremendous opportunity. You've just got to come in with us.
Build another telegraph line? Judge Selden, seems to me the country is overstocked with telegraph lines already. And they're all of them bad. Oh, Elizabeth.
Oh, Mrs. Sibley.
Oh, sit down, please. You go right ahead with your talk. I'll pour the coffee.
Well, Hiram, can I count you in?
I don't see it, Judge.
You don't?
No. Seems like a ridiculous venture, at least at this time. Right after Morse invented the telegraph, every Johnny and his cousin Mary began building telegraph lines. Result is that the country is suffering from a bad case of telegraphitis.
But, Hiram, the country's growing and the telegraph will grow with it.
Maybe so. Maybe when the men who run the telegraph industry begin to get some idea of what the public expects, what it wants, maybe then it will amount to something.
Well, I must say I'm disappointed in your reaction, Hiram.
That's the way I feel about it, Judge. As things stand now, I want no part of the telegraph.
Well, then I suppose there's no use taking up more of your time. I'll be getting on.
Oh, but you will stay and have some coffee.
Sorry, afraid not, Mrs. Sibley. It's late. It's past my bedtime.
No hard feelings, Judge.
Oh, of course not. Won't change your mind, Hiram?
No.
Well, good night.
Good night, Judge.
Good night.
That surprises me. The judge is usually so sound in his business judgment, but this wild scheme, telegram, I don't see it. I think I'll sit and read in the parlor for a bit, Elizabeth. Have you seen that book I was reading?
The Federalist Papers?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I put it on your desk in the study. Is it an interesting book?
Very interesting. The arguments of Hamilton, Madison, and some of the other great statesmen of the time for the need of a strong national government. You wouldn't think they had to fight for the Constitution, argue for it, but they had to. They had to show that the country would never get anywhere as long as the states kept apart, each rivaling the other. They showed that the only way the country could survive was with a strong central authority.
Seems to me, Hiram, that that's just what the telegraph companies need.
Yeah?
Well, isn't that right?
You mean some central authority?
Well, something to bring them together so they can serve the people efficiently. So they can give the country what it needs, a responsible, dependable, cheap way of sending messages across the country.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going up to bed. Good night, dear.
Good night. Let's put it this way, Judge. I changed my mind.
You astonish me, Hiram.
Why?
Well, you seemed so set in your views when we spoke together last week.
The only things I know of that never change their minds are mad dogs and politicians. I'm neither. I'm a businessman. I'll come in with you, Judge, but with one reservation.
And that?
Simply this. The main objective of our business will not be just to build another telegraph line to the Mississippi. Our goal will be to gather all of the telegraph lines in our territory under a single vigorous enterprise, one that will serve the public first, last, and always. On that basis, I'll come in.
On that basis, Hiram, it's a deal.
On On September 6, 1850, Hiram Sibley, Judge Samuel Selden, and a group of other prominent Rochester businessmen formed the New York and Mississippi Valley Printing Telegraph Company. As soon as all the details were set, Hiram Sibley, battered old traveling bag in hand, began to wander along the highways and byways of the backcountry of the Middle West. He began to lay the groundwork of his dream.
Hello there, blacksmith. I say hello.
Hi.
Are you Mr. Kittleheim?
Yep.
My name is Hiram Sibley. I'm very glad to meet you.
Shoe? Got a horse to shoe? Well, bring the critter in.
No, I said I was glad to meet you.
I'm a trifle deep. Emmy, come here and find out what this fellow wants.
Come in.
Pretty hot weather, isn't it, Mr. Kittleheim?
No. Ain't gonna vote for that fella. Gonna vote straight Whig ticket.
You be wanting something, mister?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Hiram Sibley. I've been told that your husband owns some stock in the Cleveland and Cincinnati Telegraph Company. Is that right?
Wished it was, but 'tis.
What's he saying, Emmy?
He ain't said nothing yet, Paul.
Well, then I'll get back to work.
No, no, wait. I'd like to talk to you about the stock. Do you have it here?
Part of it.
Part of it?
Had a mighty fine engraving of Jackson on it. We got it framed inside. Pretty picture.
You've got the stock framed?
No, just the picture. Cut it out and fixed it real nice.
But where's the rest of the certificate?
Hmm? Let me see now. Oh, sure enough. It's patched over the leak we had in the kitchen. Mighty strong paper. Holds out the water real good.
Well, what's he saying?
He ain't doing any saying, Paul. I'm doing all the saying so far.
Well, get to it. Get to it.
Mrs. Kittleheim, I'd like to buy the stock.
You're fooling.
No, I'm not. I'll give you $20 for it.
Paul, he said...
I heard him. Ain't you deep to hear a fool offering good cash for a water patch. Emmy, go fetch the pitcher and the paper before this here sucker squirms off the hook.
Well, there they are, Judge. Contracts with the Lake Erie Company, the Cleveland and Ohio Company, the Ohio Telegraph Company. I'm tired, worn out.
You've done a fine job, Hiram. Only...
Only what?
Well, while you've been gone, we've been working on the Erie and Michigan Telegraph Company. Ezra Cornell's outfit.
Oh, yeah. Any success?
Very little. Oh, we've managed to convince his two partners that consolidation would benefit both our lines. But old Ezra is the original lone wolf. He'll have no part of it.
And without the Erie and Michigan, we're sunk. Their lines are the lines we need to really round out our system.
That's right.
Well, I'll be on my way.
Going home, Hiram?
Nope. I'm going to New York to beard a lone wolf in his den. Young man, is Mr. Ezra Cornell in?
He might be, and then again, he might not. Who shall I say wants to see him?
Mr. Hiram Sibley.
What? Come again?
Mr. Hiram Sibley.
Mr. Hiram Sibley?
Yes, please announce me.
Oh, my. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my.
Is something wrong?
Not yet, but when I tell Mr. Cornell that you're out here, I reckon everything's gonna go wrong. You ain't got no weapons on you, have you?
Don't be ridiculous.
Well, all right. But don't say I ain't warned you. Mr. Hiram Sibley. Just wait till I tell that to Mr. Cornell.
Simply, I'll take the liberty of inviting you to get out of my office.
Now, wait a minute.
I'm grateful of the opportunity you've given me to tell you what I think of you face to face.
You can call me a pirate, Cornell, a line grabber, a gripsack buccaneer. I don't care what you call me.
Going around buying up telegraph stock as if it were corn or potatoes. A fine way of doing business.
I've paid spot cash for every bit of telegraph stock I've bought, and I've given a fair price for value received.
You're trying to suppress competition.
Cornell, I'm an old Yankee. I was nursed on competition. I think it's a fine thing. When the public profits from it by low prices and better service. But that's not what is happening in the telegraph field. But now let's calm down and see this thing sensibly. Business with the Erie in Michigan is bad, isn't it?
Well,
it's bad.
Yes.
And it's bad with our line, too. Why? Because the people can't afford to use the telegraph. Rates are too high. They're too high because costs are double all along the line. Two offices for everyone we need. Two sets of lines to be repaired. Two of everything. It doesn't make sense.
Are you trying to set yourself up as some sort of public benefactor, Sibley?
No, I'm just a businessman. And so are you. What's good for the public is good for business. And you can turn that around. What's good for business is good for the people. Now, honestly, you believe that too, don't you, Cornell?
I suppose you've figured out the financial angle.
Yes, I have the figures here. I'll leave them with you. We'll get together.
Sibley, we should have met before this. I might have had a different idea about you.
Quite possibly. I'm staying at the Commercial Hotel. Let me know when you read the contract.
You'll find
them satisfactory.
Maybe. But one thing.
Yeah?
One thing I want you to know right now. This idea may be yours. This arrangement yours. But if I decide to agree, which I don't say I will, but if I do decide to agree, the name of our company must be my choice.
Well, what is the name, Cornell?
One I've had in mind for a long time. Western Union.
Western Union. I like it.
By 1860, the Western Union Telegraph Company gave the people the means of instantaneous communication from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River. It was a going concern, successful, reliable, prosperous. But Hiram Sibley wasn't satisfied. He had an idea. Another idea.
Pacific, Mr. Sibley? You serious? You want Western Union to build a telegraph line to California?
I'm deadly serious, Mr. Morris.
Well, now, that's a big project. A very big project.
A little too big, I should say. Mr. Sibley, now, do you expect to string a line 1,500 miles across the wilderness, across a land infested with Indians, to drag poles out there where there isn't even a tree within hundreds of miles? It won't work.
Gentlemen, do I take it that the rest of you are infected with the same timidity that seems to have overcome Mr. Mann? You won't come in with me on a line to the Pacific? Very well, then. If you won't join hands with me in this, I'll go it alone.
Hiram.
Yes, Judge?
I've always been with you, believed in you, and worked with you. But this isn't the place for personal feelings. I think these gentlemen are right. The project is much too tenuous for our company to undertake. Because if it fails, the damage to our whole enterprise would be enormous.
All right.
Now, wait a minute. I've got a compromise. You go ahead and build the line. I'll come in with you personally, as will many of the others, I'm sure. Use Western Union men, use Western Union resources. Everything and anything you want. And when the line is finished, we'll undertake to operate. Now, what about that?
For the second time, Judge, it's a deal.
In Washington, Sibley's idea of a transcontinental telegraph line was warmly received by Congress. On June 16, 1860, an act was passed to facilitate communication between the Atlantic and Pacific states by electric telegraph. It was to be done in 2 years from the start of construction, if it could be done at all. In May of 1861, the line east from California was begun at Placerville. July 4, 1861, the line west was begun from Fort Kearney, Nebraska. Reports on progress flew across the lines of Western Union to Hiram Sibley in Rochester.
You have it in full, Bill?
Yes, sir. This needs
to be all,
Mr. Sibley.
Let me see.
Anything serious, Hiram?
From Creighton, superintendent of the line going into Salt Lake City. Listen. Contractor refused to deliver poles.
What?
Only 5 days' supply left. No chance to cut our own, as country here is almost barren. Please advise.
What are you going to do?
We've beaten our way this far. Indians haven't stopped us. Rivers haven't. Mountains, deserts, we've beaten them all. And now a lumber contractor thinks he can stop us. Well, he can't. Judge, you'll have to look after things here for a while.
I don't see what good that will do.
I don't either, but I'm going west. I'll get Creighton the poles he needs if I have to carry them from the Missouri to Salt Lake City on my back.
Well, I'm glad to see you, Mr. Sibley, but there was no real reason for you to come out here. I've straightened things out.
Then you're getting your poles straightened?
Oh, yes, I'm getting them. Just made the final arrangements. Of course, they're costing us a lot more than we figured.
Now, hold up.
More or less, yes. But I decided it was best to take what we could get. You see, the contractor happens to be, he's a rather close relative to the man who more or less does the driving out here. Brigham Young.
Yeah, I see.
Yes, I... come in.
Excuse me. I was told that I would find Mr. Edward Creighton here.
Yes, I'm Creighton.
I'm Brigham Young.
Mr. Hiram Sibley, Mr. Young.
Mr. Sibley.
How do you do, sir?
Mr. Creighton, I'm told that one of my relatives entered into a contract with you to furnish poles for the telegraph.
Yes, sir.
Is it also true that the price agreed upon in this contract was subsequently raised?
That's right, sir.
Let me see those contracts, please.
Right here, sir.
Mr. Creighton, tear up this contract. The poles will be furnished by my relative in accordance with the terms of the original agreement.
May we have some quiet, please? Quiet! Would somebody please shut that door so we can hear ourselves think?
Folks have come from hundreds of miles around for this celebration, Mr. Creighton. Ain't nobody going to shut them up.
Yes, I suppose not. Mr. Sibley, we're all ready.
Try to raise Port Kearney.
Yes, sir. Send CQ to Port Kearney.
Port Kearney, yes, sir. We're in contact, sir.
The line is through. Mr. Sibley, the line is through.
The line is through. The line is through.
Instead of the 2 years limit set for the undertaking, Hiram Sibley built the first transcontinental telegraph line in less than 5 months. 132 days from the start of construction, a picket fence of poles stretched from west to east, clean across the continent, and was ready to send the first message scudding across its singing wire.
Judge Field, the operator's ready. Will you dictate the message?
Yes, thank you. To Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, the people of California desire to congratulate you upon the completion of this great work. They believe that it will be the means of strengthening the attachment which binds both the East and the West to the Union. And they desire in this the first message across the continent to express their loyalty to the Union and their determination to stand by its government on this, its day of trial. They regard the government with affection and will adhere to it under all fortunes. Stephen J. Field, Chief Justice of California.
At the moment of crisis, with the country at the brink of civil war, a thin wire helped draw the nation together, brought the Pacific to the Atlantic in the wink of a second, a flash of time. In Washington, Hiram Sibley figured the job was over.
Help you, sir. Oh, Mr. Sibley.
Hello, Luther. Busy?
Oh, gracious. Always busy, sir.
Will you send this wire for me?
Yes, sir. Can I have it? Mrs. Elizabeth Sibley, that's your wife, Rochester, New York. Business successfully concluded. Leaving Washington today. Arrive home Tuesday. Love, Hiram. Ain't you forgetting something, Mr. Sibley?
How's that?
Nothing here about kissing the children. You can kiss him now for just a few pennies more.
Luther, there's a time in a man's life when he stops kissing his children and they begin to kiss him. It's one of the ways a man knows when he's getting old. It's 11 years now since I sent that first message, remember?
Yes, sir. Like it was yesterday.
Well, if nothing else, the 11 years has saved me the expense of telegraphing kisses to my kids. Just send the wire as it is, Luther.
Yes, Mr. Sibley.
I hope the wire will arrive before Wednesday.
Oh, it'll be in Rochester within the hour. And you can depend on that, sir.
You can depend on that, Luther. You've just said it. That's the greatest thing, the whole 11 years in a nutshell. The whole story of Western Union.
A 100 years is not too long a span of time, and yet, in a single century, the telegraph industry has grown from nothing into a vast network that binds every village of our country with every other hamlet, town, and city. This is a monument to Hiram Sibley. It's a monument to enterprise, courage, and faith. To many men who have worked many years to make private industry serve the needs of all the people. Cavalcade of America, directed by John Zoller, came to you this evening from the stage of the Vanderbilt Theater in New York and is presented by the DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
The Cavalcade of America on Tuned to Yesterday from the 30th of August, 1949 on NBC. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.